A very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Robert Bound. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be taking a look at countries that have slipped off the historical map, asking historian Norman Davies what dictates decline.
Parallel with the human body is rather similar. What is the moment of death? What of all the ailments that we have, you know, may eventually kill us? We don't know.
From Cairo, we'll be hearing about the launch of a new Egyptian news agency and mentoring of a different kind with theatre director Peter Sellers. All that right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, it's time for the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Syria has incurred more European sanctions and criticism from Turkey and Jordan after a surprise Arab League decision to suspend it for failing to halt months of violence aimed at crushing opposition to President Bashar al-Assad. Syria looks ever more isolated but still has the support of Russia, which said the Arab League had made the wrong move and accused the West of inciting Assad's opponents. Speaking before the decision, the Arab League Secretary General Nabil al-Arabi confirmed that unless action was taken, Syria would be suspended.
What the Arab League is demanding from the Syrian government is an end to the violence, because the Syrian people are suffering. What is being sought is a framework to offer protection. This is a new issue for the Arab League.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel said today that Europe could be living through its toughest hour since World War II, as new leaders in Italy and Greece rush to form governments and limit the damage from the Eurozone debt crisis. A rally on financial markets, sparked by the appointment of respected European technocrats in Rome and Athens, soon stalled. Analysts warned that daunting obstacles could hinder decisive action needed to breathe new life into their ailing economies. President Barack Obama has told China that the United States was fed up with its trade and currency practices. He turned up the heat on America's biggest economic rival at the Asia-Pacific summit. Using some of his toughest language yet against China, Obama, a day after face-to-face talks with President Hu Jintao, demanded that China stop gaming the international economic system and create a level playing field for U.S. and other foreign businesses.
We're going to continue to be firm in insisting that operate by the same rules that everybody else operates under. We don't want them taking advantage of the United States or U.S. businesses.
The Obama administration, in the latest in a string of executive moves to sidestep a divided U.S. Congress, has announced up to $1 billion for a program to support healthcare innovation, to cut costs and improve care. The money will award grants in March to people who come up with the best ideas to lift care and save money for people enrolled in federal healthcare programs. The Norwegian anti-immigration militant Anders Behring Breivik spoke in open court for the first time today and admitted killing 77 people at a July youth camp, but he denied any guilt, saying he was a military commander in a far-right resistance movement. At one point, Breivik attempted to address survivors of Norway's biggest modern-day massacre, but the judge cut him off. 3,000 troops backed by helicopters and armoured cars have occupied Rio de Janeiro's largest slum without firing a shot, the biggest step in the Brazilian city's bid to improve security and end the reign of drugs gangs. The occupation of Rocinha, a notorious hillside favela that overlooks some of Rio's swankiest areas, is a crucial part of the city's preparation to host soccer's World Cup in 2014 and the Olympics 2 years later. The Rio State Governor hailed it as a major and lasting blow to the reign of the drugs gangs.
Together we have conquered this, and it is together that we will conquer the territories that are still held by the gangs. We are showing that this is a permanent action, a unifying action together with the citizens.
One in 10 adults will have diabetes by 2030, posing a huge challenge to healthcare systems around the world, according to a report out today. The International Diabetes Federation said the number of people living with the disease is expected to soar to 552 million by 2030, equating to 3 new cases every 10 seconds, up from 366 million in 2011, unless urgent action is taken. Finally, on a happy note, a cat has climbed up a giant cactus in the Arizona desert and stayed there for several days. The feline was spotted on top of a saguaro cactus by a hiker in a desert located in Mesa, about 32 kilometres from Phoenix. The cat stayed on top of the cactus, reported to be at least 6 metres high, for at least 3 days. After attracting a lot of attention, notably from overhead television helicopters, the cat simply climbed down the cactus and headed home. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Well, I'm glad there are still TV choppers and news choppers enough to film Cats Up Cactuses.
Hardly a top story, but
hardly
anyway.
a bottom story. Here's the Brolly Watch, the international global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Cold autumn weather has arrived in Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw's Monday high only 2 degrees. The west of Europe, on the other hand, is still mild. And in the UK, it's so far been one of the mildest Novembers on record. Here's Tuesday's city forecast. Berlin, 3 degrees, cloudy. Paris, 13 and sunny. London, 12 degrees, cloudy here. Barcelona, 18 degrees, showers and thunder. And at the airports, poor weather over Iberia, so downpours arriving at Madrid airport, but quiet crossing the Atlantic, just a weak jet stream. Over to North America, rain for the start of the week in some major cities like New York, but in the second half of the week, that will bring a lot more rain. The entire eastern half of the United States will get the rain. Here's Tuesday's city forecast. In San Francisco, 17, nice and sunny. Chicago, 12 and sunny. New York City, 17 and rain. Washington, D.C., 18 degrees Celsius with some rain. And air travel, JFK, Dulles, Miami, weather not too bad for flights around the eastern seaboard for the next 24 hours. The Far East now, Japan, and cold winds will bring snow to Hokkaido this week. Sapporo will get some winter weather during Tuesday. Otherwise, the start of the week is looking sunny across most of Japan. The end of the week, however, is looking very wet. So, Tuesday's city forecast in Tokyo, 15 and sunny. Osaka, 17 and sunny. In Bangkok, 34 with scattered clouds. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas Schaffernacker. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time's approaching 8 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Turkish journalist Akin Atakin about how the capital and the country feel about neighbouring Syria. But first, a little break.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. Monocle 24. This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Monocle
24.
You're tuned into Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, in the last 24 hours, Turkey withdrew families of its diplomats in Syria. It's the latest in a spate of diplomatic skirmishes between the two nations. With Syria's mounting instability, Turkey now finds itself middleman between Europe and a fractured Arab region. Akin Atakin is a journalist for Turkish media company ACT TV, and he joins us now from Istanbul to talk with Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, who's joined us in studio, and with myself. Akin, hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Good. Well, I wanted to ask you first off, what are the Turkish headlines at the moment, and how outraged are they, or are they just used to this now?
Well, the television stations seem to be used to it, but the analysts are still talking about it. But what they're talking about it is mostly the role of the U.S. in Turkey's role in the region, and that Turkey might be returning to a more Western dependent foreign policy rather than the zero problem independent autonomous foreign policy. The analysts have said that the U.S. President Barack Obama's definite support to the Turkish government is the only thing that that the American government can do, because Obama, and I quote, wants to take advantage of Turkey's position in the Middle East and its autonomous influence. And they have all been, all the newspapers have been quoting Turkish Foreign Minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, who said that Turkey will show the toughest stance, will show the most decisive stance against any attacks that will be carried out against its citizens in Syria.
And does this feel like a proper sea change in Turkey then at the moment? I mean, does the pressure feel like it's been ratcheted up to a period that it hasn't before?
It has been like this before when the masses started moving to Turkey from the Syrian border. The tension between the Syrian and the Turkish government started escalating. The Turkish prime minister before called Bashar Assad his brother, but after a while, after these violence started happening in Syria, he said that Bashar Assad did not keep his promise, and that's why he was not a friend of his anymore. However, with the latest attacks on the Turkish government, Ahmet Davutoğlu on the Turkish diplomatic offices, Davutoğlu said that, the Turkish foreign minister said that despite the fact that Turkey is keeping its diplomatic representatives in Syria, they have recalled the families, and in fact the families of the diplomatic staff have returned home. And he said that Turkey will take further reactionary steps against Syria and the Syrian government, but he didn't elaborate on as to what these steps will be. And he pointed the Turkish Arab cooperation meeting that will be held on Wednesday in Morocco to decide these further steps. But he did hold a meeting with the Syrian opposition members at his house last night that lasted for hours.
Akin, hello, this is Steve in the studio alongside Rob. Is there a sense that the Turkish government has been slightly naive in their dealings with Syria, in that for several months now, officials, the president, the prime minister, the foreign minister, have been going to Damascus saying to Bashar al-Assad and his government, look, guys, you know, this isn't really the way to go. You should bring in reforms. And they say, yeah, OK, we'll do that, we'll do that. And then as soon as the Turkish delegation goes back to Ankara, they carry on, you know, killing the protesters. Is there a sense that, you know, perhaps they've been, that the Turkish government's been taken for a ride a bit?
Yes, there definitely is a sense of that. In fact, one of the reasons, this is what the analysts are pointing out in Turkey nowadays, that Tayyip Erdogan's sharp turn from calling Assad his brother to almost his enemy is that Bashar Assad did not keep any of the promises that he made to Turkey. Because Turkey is acting like a liaison in the Middle East, as you said at the beginning of the program, between Europe and the Arab world, and it's trying to gain credibility in its foreign policies. In fact, one of the Turkish columnists said today that Turkey's foreign policy shows two very significant, very clear characteristics. One is confidence, and the other one is pride. And that confidence is necessary to see the future and to establish an effective foreign policy, but pride is like a poisonous food for the government because they overreact to situations. So yes, Turkey has been confident in dealing with Syria. As you said, they have been sending delegations to Syria, talking to Bashar Assad, and trying to show the world that they are in fact capable of handling this problem. However, when Bashar Assad did not keep his promises, that pride side of the foreign policy character started coming out as well. But I must say that the analysts and the media and political scientists in Turkey don't seem to be too surprised by the extent to which the events have arrived.
And Akin, I wanted to ask you what the attitude of the Arab League was, having Syria called for an emergency meeting yesterday. Saudi Arabia presumably are a large actor in this as well. What are the Turks and the Saudis speaking with each other presumably about this, and how much has that been reported?
Not much between the Turkish and the Saudi Arabian governments have been reported. In fact, from what I've seen today on the news, both on TV and in the newspapers, I have not come across anything between Turkey and Saudi Arabia being agreed upon. However, the common shared, the shared anger towards the Assad regime and the shared goal of imposing more sanctions on the Assad regime to force it to leave, these are the two shared goals of both governments. However, the attention is not focusing too much on the Saudi Arabian and the Turkish cooperation on handling this issue.
And I wondered, I mean, is this something that's sort of playing itself out? I mean, obviously you're part of ACT TV. I mean, are you desperately busy purely with this story at the moment, or is it sort of cooling down, or does it, is it sort of fluctuating as the minutes go by?
It is definitely the top story in Turkey at the moment, because the minister of the Council of Ministers today have met, and so new developments have been happening. And the Council of Ministers, according to the allegations, no official declaration has been made. But from what we gathered from the sources, the Council of Ministers discussed two points, along with, of course, other agenda points like recovering from the earthquake. Regarding Syria, there were two points that were discussed. One is that if things go further and the attacks continue, the Council of Ministers may decide freezing all diplomatic ties with Syria and pulling the Turkish ambassador back from Damascus. And the second option is to officially recognize the Syrian National Council that's based in Turkey and to allow them to open headquarters and officially recognize the Syrian opposition. So what Davutoğlu said as the toughest stance may actually come true if the attacks carry on in Syria. That's why this topic is still being hotly debated in Turkey.
And just finally, does this feel like, the moment when Istanbul and Turkey cements its place as the logical and bona fide bridge between East and West, between not only Europe and the Middle East, but America and the Middle East too?
I'm sorry, could you please repeat that question?
I wondered whether there's a general consensus and whether the media are picking up on potentially the feeling that this is Istanbul and Turkey's moment, that it becomes the bona fide bridge between Europe and the US and the Middle East in matters such as this.
Yes, many people have come to the point of perceiving Istanbul as a solid bridge between the East and the West now that it has established its place. However, people usually, the analysts and the columnists usually believe that Turkey and Istanbul have strengthened their positions incredibly after gaining Obama's full support. In fact, not long ago, Turkish President Abdullah Gül said that the relations between Turkey and the U.S. were at its best. And Turkey is now viewed by also by the Turkish people as the U.S.'s biggest chance of maintaining its influence in the region. Therefore, there is that sense that Turkey is strengthening its position as a regional actor. However, the increasing alliance between Iran and Syria is also worrying people, because Turkey has been following that zero-problem policy with its neighbors, which has helped strengthen its position in the international arena and as a bridge between the East and the West, and the U.S. and the East. But that the more Iran and Syria get closer, the more Turkey will have to deal with in the Middle East and will have to pick a side, so to say.
All right, Ekin. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be sure to be clicking refresh every 30 seconds to keep up to date with this story. Thank you very much for joining us on the line from Istanbul.
Thank you, and good luck with the program.
Thank you. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this track. It's, what is it? It's the Real Estate Band. That was the lovely sounding It's Real by the badly named Real Estate Band. They couldn't sell us anything. After the break, we'll hear from the author Norman Davies about his book Vanished Kingdoms, an encyclopedic new jaunt through the Europe that preceded the current one as we know it today. You're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bounds. We'll be back here in a second.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. As we cast about for examples to help us reason our way through the European financial and political freakout, perhaps history is our best teacher. Professor Norman Davies' new book, Vanished Kingdoms, inspects 15 such kingdoms, duchies, empires and republics from 4th century Tolosa, now Toulouse, to the fall of the Soviet Union. I started off by asking Professor Davies, when I met him earlier today, about the book's genesis and, with an eye on contemporary Europe, what common themes conspire to kill a country. When and where did you sort of decide to write a book about the vanished kingdoms of half-forgotten Europe, and how did you decide which ones to leave in and out?
I don't remember exactly when the idea crystallised, but I think the evaporation of the Soviet Union, as I called it, had a big influence. I had, as an academic, had a lot to do with Russia and Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. It was the big beast in our little zoo. It was one of the world's superpowers, and there's a whole industry based on the presumed continuing existence of the Soviet Union.
A history industry, you mean?
Well, history, yeah. Political science, economists. There's a whole shoal of academics who were preoccupied with the Soviet Union, and it went up in smoke in the space of a few months. The biggest state in the world, the state with the biggest nuclear arsenal, the biggest security forces the world has ever seen, and it disappeared. And this, of course, set me thinking quite a lot. And of course, it reminds you how fragile the world is, that what appears to be permanent and extremely powerful isn't necessarily so.
And you talk about the march of time and of history as pity. You describe it as pitiless in the book.
Yes.
And that seems to be time that seems to erode and destroy these kingdoms that you talk about in the book as much as anything else. Going from what was Burgundia to what was Aquitaine and is now modern day Toulouse. The book mm-hmm. takes in a number of different vanished kingdoms. Are there common themes about the decline and fall of these kingdoms, or are they all rather separate?
Well, they're all separate case studies, but the pitiless nature refers to the fact that time spares nobody. The changes that are occurring constantly, and which we don't always see, are nonetheless in motion, whether we like it or not. And just as all human beings are mortal, so all human institutions are mortal, even though that they're span of life may be longer. There's no state, no empire, no republic that's ever lived that was immortal. There's one or two thought that they would live for 1,000 years, and they tend to live for 10 or 12.
And namely?
Well, Third Reich.
Yeah.
But equally, the Soviet Union was a project for the whole of future history. They were talking about the building of a new Soviet man, which would eventually dominate the world and would last until all historical conflicts faded away and man lived in this perfect communist paradise. It was a sort of religious fantasy that they had, but they were thinking in terms of centuries, if not millennia, and it lasted, whatever, 70 years.
And before we get to the first chapter of your book, in the introduction, you cite Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire as, I think it was your history teacher, told you to go away and read this during your year before going to Oxford. Is Is that still sort of the set text for you? Is that what most people can learn from, the fact that the study of history is always the study of decline and studying the management or lack of management of decline in some way?
Well, Gibbon is obviously the archetype of this theme, but it's not just the study of decline. Like, he starts in the third century, I think, with the Roman Empire in all its power, might, and glory. The idea that this theme is about losers or failed states is wide of the mark. All the states, all the empires we've ever known have had their period of greatness, power, might, influence, wealth, prosperity, everything. But they all go into decline, like all of us eventually go into the decline. What is very difficult to put your finger on is the timing, when something might collapse, why something might collapse. But again, the parallel with the human body is rather similar. What is the moment of death? What of all the ailments that we have, you know, may eventually kill us? We don't know.
That was Norman Davies, author of Vanished Kingdoms. And if you want to hear more from Norman Davies, the next segment of my rather long interview with him this morning will be premiered in The Globalist tomorrow morning. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up after this is the news.
LDNTYO. NYCMT4.
And here is Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Rob. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel said today that Europe could be living through its toughest hour since World War II, as new leaders in Italy and Greece rush to form governments and limit the damage from the Eurozone debt crisis. Policymakers and bankers say the Eurozone has to tread a narrow path sown with landmines in the next few weeks to survive perhaps the most dangerous phase of its sovereign debt crisis. Greece's conservatives have vowed to reject any new austerity measures in return for the aid that is keeping Athens from bankruptcy, signalling a new coalition government that may not enjoy the kind of cross-party support its lenders demand. Former European Commissioner Mario Monti worked to form a new government today, replacing Silvio Berlusconi, that will try to reverse a disastrous collapse of market confidence in Italy. Syria has incurred more European sanctions and criticism from Turkey and Jordan after a surprise Arab League decision to suspend it for failing to halt months of violence aimed at crushing opposition to President Bashar al-Assad. The US Supreme Court has agreed to decide the fate of President Obama's health care law, with an election year ruling due by July on the US health care system's biggest overhaul in nearly 50 years. Police today moved into an anti-Wall Street protester encampment in Oakland, California, clearing out occupants and taking down tents there. Egyptians are facing a blizzard of posters and TV adverts seeking their votes in the first free parliamentary election in decades. Some campaigners are turning to tricks like tearing down rival posters in a race where every vote counts. A Sudanese opposition leader says Sudan could see the next Arab revolution because anger is rising over an economic crisis and government repression worse than in Egypt before the ousting of Hosni Mubarak. And three astronauts blasted off today to return a full crew to the International Space Station as Russia seeks to restore confidence in its space program after the crash of a cargo spaceship and several botched launches. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for the news headlines, Nick Kelly. I see you dropped the cat story.
Well, the cat didn't make it to the summary. You know, we only have the important things like the botched launches.
Okay.
Nothing worse than a botched launch.
Nothing worse than a botched launch. Coming up after a quick song, we're going to be speaking to the head of the foundation, keeping an eye on the Egyptian elections. And this will be Baby Missiles by The War on Drugs. That was Baby Missiles by The War on Drugs, a rather strangely named band to come out of the news with and to go to Egypt with. But anyway, They sound good to us. And we go to Egypt now. With elections in Egypt on the horizon, the need for independent and accurate reporting is critical. For a country unaccustomed to election reporting, the Thomson Reuters Foundation has helped launch Azwat Misrawi, a news agency and website run by Egyptian and Arab team of journalists and editors. To talk about this more, we have Monique Villa, the foundation's CEO, in the studio. And on the line from Cairo, Heba Khandil, Reuters Middle East and North African editor, who has been working closely on the project. Welcome, Monique.
Hello.
And welcome, Heba, as well.
Hello.
Hi. Well, I'll start off with Monique in the studio. Thanks for coming in. I wanted to ask really straight away, when you, after you were allowed to get into Egypt, after the last regime had fallen, how quickly did you decide to sort of come up with something specifically to keep an eye on the Egyptian elections?
The Reuters Bureau is in permanence in Egypt. I mean, we covered the revolution day after day. I mean, we are always there. Indeed, Reuters is in Egypt since 1866, so it's 150 years we are there.
You should be ruling the place.
What happened is that we did many journalist trainings in Egypt in the 2 years before the revolution. I don't mean at all that we teach them how to do a revolution, but how you cover news, etc. And so after the revolution, they turned to us and said, you know, it would be critical if we could have access to totally independent news in Egypt on the elections. So we decided to create this website and to cover the elections in Egypt totally independently, in Arabic, of course, because this is what they speak in Egypt. And so we got funding and we launched it 1 month ago, and we will have it running for 1 year. So it's a website where you can find any news, data, information on the Egyptian elections. And you have everything about the voting districts, the election laws, etc. And it explains also to first-time voters about their voting rights, etc., which is very important, as you know. You have profiles of all the parliamentary and presidential candidates. And you have a full summary about the parties contesting the elections and their platform. But what has been really nice in the 1 month running of this website under the authority of EBA is that we have break news. We have broken news. So even Reuters has taken the news from the Thomson Reuters Foundation website to use them.
And does it feel like you're sort of entering a sort of new frontier with this? I mean, it must be a sort of great thing to be able to be sort of starting afresh or helping people start afresh. I wondered if you can trace the clicks on this website and see whether people from other fledgling democracies in the region are tuning in and logging on to find out how it's working in Egypt.
I think I will let Heba answer, because she speaks Arabic much better than I, and so she can probably answer much better.
Well, we'll let you answer that, Heba. I presume you heard that.
Yes, I did. You're asking about whether other countries other than Egypt are logging on to the website and curious to see what's out there. Yeah. And the answer is yes. In fact, a lot of the people who've clicked and used our website come from Saudi Arabia. Some of them come from other Western democracies, and I imagine that's the Egyptian expats and maybe other Arab expats who are looking curiously to look at the Egyptian example, what's going on with the elections, you know, and those would be the second elections after the Arab Spring, the first being Tunisia, of course. So, yeah, there's a lot of good interest, pan-regional interest so far.
And I wonder what you could learn from the Tunisian elections. I mean, they seem to be to go off peacefully and to be a success. Does that hearten you for your sort of journalistic adventure and training scheme in Egypt?
Well, of course, you know, the whole Arab world has been looking to each other. Tunisia ignited the whole Arab Spring, so it's not unusual that people are looking at their, you know, the fruits of their Arab Spring, how it's come about as well. And of course, Egyptians have been sort of, there's a lot of Egyptian journalists who went out to Tunisia to cover the elections there. But I'm really happy, and I'm really, really happy to have something like Aswat Misrawi Australia launched at this critical time, because really Egyptians have become so heartened. We feel that there's a feeling that there's an ownership in the elections to come, but at the same time they're novice. This is their first real experience at parliamentary elections, so to speak. So it really provides a real good source of critical and independent information. That's the key.
I like the way you sang independent there. I think that's a fairly important word for you then.
For us, indeed. Absolutely. It's all about accuracy, independence, and facts. And so, of course, we have also a little bit of analysis and comments and blogs, but the core coverage is totally. We try to be as objective as possible.
And I want to ask you, Monique, first about the. It's a news agency, but it's also a website, and I presume it includes elements of social media. There's obviously a conversation that you have to have with the people that are logging on and checking out the news and the facts and the voting districts and what their rights are with this thing. I wanted to ask you how important the element of social media is, but I also wanted to ask you secondarily about how easy it is to police what goes up on it and whether you really need to.
This is for Eba to answer on the discussion in Egypt in Arabic, because obviously I would be speaking very generically. But what I can say, the whole foundation, because we have a lot of websites, not only in Egypt, we have the first humanitarian website with AlertNet, and we have a TrustLaw website, which is all about women's rights around the world and anti-corruption. So we have loads of blogs and of Facebook and Twitter following there too. And we let it free. We let people put what they put, as long as it's very clear it's not the Thomson Reuters Foundation who speaks.
And Heba, I wanted to ask you about the social media element of it. I mean, does it feel like you need to police things, or are people just very glad to be able to express their views and have a forum on which to do it? I mean, how much of it do you have to make sure is actual news and rather than just hearsay?
Well, we have to stick very to the guidelines of neutral and unbiased information in journalism. And of course, we're trying to encourage as much as possible feedback from the audience. But there still has to be some kind of restriction, as I would suspect with all websites or most websites that try to convey that they are unbiased and independent. Social media is very important to our website. Number one, we are a website, so like it or not, we are a part of the new media. We have a section catered to blogs, so we want to read the most important blogs that have been written by prominent bloggers out there on elections, and we have a very good section on multimedia that also encourages sort of like this new wave forward. We want to make it very interactive and reach all the people who log on to social media as well. So there's a lot of emphasis and focus on those elements. And of course, most of our clicks and users have come through Facebook, for example. So we grew from 50 Facebook users to 1,500 Facebook likes in about a month. So we're really happy with that.
So they're very much the vibe of Al Masriya is a conversation. It is not the voice of God. It is about learning from the potential voters as much as it is them learning from the news that's given to them. That's a question for you, Heba.
I'm sorry. Sorry, I didn't hear that.
I was suggesting that it's very much a sort of conversation rather than the voice of God of a news agency telling people on the ground what's going on. You're obviously encouraging potential voters to tell their stories and to share their information and intelligence with each other.
Well, sure. I mean, the main service that Aswat Masriya wants to provide is credible, unbiased information. And really, the voters or the media or the voters, they make their choice in the end. The media uses all this credible information as either a tool, so static information about the political parties, about the legal issues out there, and of course, the Aswath Masraya branded news, because we have our own breaking news, as Monique referred to, so they're welcome to use that, and we encourage that, in fact, as long as they brand and they credit Aswath Masraya. And I think that's more of our role. We're definitely not the voice of God. We're not trying to be the voice of God, but we're trying to be a filter, a neutral platform amid any chaos.
And a resource for Egyptians' media, and for the Egyptian people, because it's the place where you can find every information, every detail on how it works, etc. We have been training a lot of Egyptians journalists, and it has been in the last years, and only this year we have trained something like 55 journalists, which is quite a lot, because in that country there is such an appetite to be trained at, you know, the rules of Reuters, because what we do is to bring them to our standards, and there is a lot of appetite for that. So it's very comforting to see that, frankly.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, I mean, the training, I mean, how did you, with the training, how does that work? Does that...
The trainings we do could be on anything. First, it could be on how you cover an election. It could be on, in Africa, we have done a lot of trainings on how you cover HIV/AIDS, mm-hmm. because it's better than the journalists know what they write about, that when they don't know, which could be dangerous, as we know. And so we train on how you cover business, how you cover all kind of things. But in Egypt, it has really, because it's such a new democracy, it has been really a training on how you cover elections, what it means to be responsible, independent, accurate, etc. And you know, when you don't know very well what is a source, just to explain to journalists what is exactly a source and why you have to give your source when you write. Very often in these countries, journalists think, you know, I am the source.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, Monique, and thanks, Heba Kandil, for joining us on the line from Cairo. I did, by the way, mean the news god, not any particular. Very particular god there.
If there is
a news god, exactly. I think that's very much in doubt. Heba Kandil, thank you very much for joining us on the line from Cairo, and Monique Villa. Thank you very much for joining us here in the studio. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package. Looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics, Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programs you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, Studio One, with me, Robert Bound. Our Monocle, we talk a lot about the importance of apprenticeships and of mentoring, but it's usually our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, talking about this in the context of craft and design. But Rolex's Mentor and Protégé Arts initiative moves apprenticeships into the cultural area with their philanthropic programme to assist rising artists in the field of dance, film, theatre, literature, music, and the visual arts. Tonight in New York, the 2012 mentorship programme will be announced, but to get a sense of how this scheme works and what can be achieved, we have on the line theatre director Peter Sellers, who's just spent a year mentoring Lebanese actor, writer, and director Aya Zabib. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks. It's a total pleasure to finally be on Fabulous Monocle.
Well, we're both pleased to have you. Thanks for being so bright and bushy-tailed this afternoon from New York. I wanted to ask you first, how difficult is it mentoring and teaching? You obviously know 101 million things, but how easy is it to pass it on to somebody else?
the only thing that's being passed on is incredible friendship with somebody who's like so sensational, somebody who is such a life force, somebody who you think, oh my God, the 21st century is going to be fine if she's on if she's coming down the pipeline. I mean, it's really, it's thrilling is what it is. And what's going on is she's passing it on to me. You know, what's super wonderful is to be with an artist who is up against it. You know, in Lebanon, the political situation is not too easy, and the status of women is not too high. And to be with this courageous, independent, and generous, and gorgeous woman is actually a pleasure day to day. And for me to be able to go to Beirut and actually see what people are in the middle of, how they're trying to find a language to talk about the Civil War, and meanwhile, how they're trying to find a language to create a future. Part of my group are some of the people organizing the main demonstrations in downtown Beirut, you know, 38,000 people in March, and how you go forward in the Arab Spring. And nothing could be more exciting than, I have to say, Rolex's kind of magic carpet, which allows me this year to travel to the Arab world and meet key Arab artists at a time when this generation is in the streets speaking, but also are in theaters, in homes, in restaurants, speaking and creating a new language and creating a new set of relationships. And theater is charged with meaning, with responsibility, and with pleasure. Because Lebanese culture is a culture of pleasure. It's a culture of incredible welcoming and incredible shared, you know, aroma.
And has it sort of, I mean, obviously your a lot of your work takes on contemporary issues and feeds off it and injects new life into old texts and old ideas and gives them that sense of contemporaneity. Is this something that sort of whetted your appetite and, you know, got your creative juices flowing since you've been working with Aya?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the big things in my life is that I also spent a whole bunch of time making new works. And among other things, I spent 15 years staging four pieces written by Amin Maalouf, the great Lebanese writer who lives in Paris, but I've never been to Lebanon. And so suddenly a whole window on the last 15 years of my work opens, and I see things I never saw before in the texts that I've spent years working on. And suddenly there's a whole new lifeline to a lot of the new work that I've been doing. And that work now has a very different trajectory and a different future because of windows and doors opened by my protege, Maya Zabib. And so she's brought me also to my own work in as well as to her work. And that's completely thrilling. And it allows me to rethink and reimagine what I thought I knew and suddenly realize I don't know it. And open myself to another set of possibilities. And or things that I've been talking about forever, and suddenly the real people don't need anyone ventriloquizing for them. And they're saying, you know what, we can handle this. Step aside, Peter. That's fantastic.
And there's, I mean, there's a lot of cultural philanthropy going on. Some initiatives are better and more fruitful than others. But why is this such a good thing? I mean, is it about the time you get to spend with people, or is it about the fact that you've been partnered with someone that clearly you've learnt from as well as they've learnt from you? I mean, is it that serendipity that you've chosen the right pal?
Well, I think, you know, the 21st century is not about tourism or colonialism. It's about human exchange. You know, we're not going in a predatory manner. We're actually going to contribute as well as to receive. And so that reciprocal energy is built into the Rolex program in a really creative and liberating way. The program is not based on delivering an artwork at the end of a certain period of time. It's based on building a human relationship, you know, that's going to go across a lifetime. And the results are about the seeds sown in this year, and the results are going to be harvested for a generation. And that's what's so moving and beautiful, because Rolex has actually given us the space, first of all, of a year, but now of a lifetime. And these are parts of the world that need to be in conversation. Again, you know, in the Arab Spring, we all see the images of, you know, people in the streets, you know, taken on a cell phone, but what you don't get is this refined, articulate expression that is actually being invented by artists at this moment.
who are really creating a new vocabulary and creating not just an attack on the tyrant who everyone wants to depose, but how do you construct and imagine a future? That's the harder question than bringing down Mubarak, is what's next? And what art is about is a few people who are really taking the trouble to construct and imagine the future with integrity, with coherence, and with daring, with a sense that everything has to be risks. You know, and that's something we're so risk-averse in the West right now. And here are people who have nothing left but the possibility of risking everything to finally make a breakthrough. And these are a courageous generation of artists, and we all have a lot to learn from them. And I think their voices are really going to resound around the world in this next decade.
And I just wanted to ask you finally, I mean, theatre is obviously a very reactive form of expression, and there's obviously a certain choreography to protest as well. I mean, will we see sort of the actuality of this sort of behaviour on stage? Will we be able to, will we see some of this stuff borne out in your work and the work of Aya?
But I think one of the interesting things that Maya and I both share is, you know, I just saw her piece on the Lebanese Civil War yesterday, and it's incredibly tender, quiet, understated, gentle, and poetic. And it's exactly the opposite of what a war reporter would tell you. You know, she goes into the same zone that everyone else sees devastation and carnage, and she emerges with something so tender, so utterly vulnerable, and so utterly generous and life-giving. And a lot of my work is also in a phase that what I'm making is something that's a song, that's actually a melody, that's in the middle of all, you know, we've got nothing but bad news piling up everywhere. So where is the heart? Where's the tenderness? Where's the forgiveness? Where's the possibility of moving to the other side of the violence and creating an atmosphere where people can live and let live? That zone is the zone that we can actually begin to hold as artists. And I think of it as the protected zone, the space where nobody has to die in order to say something.
Well, Pete,
and you feel that tenderness in her work, and I think that's one of the things we both share. And if I could just say, my newest work is investing in very high-quality microphones to say very intimate truth, which I view in parallel with the street demonstrations with crude microphones to chant slogans. And I think this world now needs people in the streets and these incredible slogans, but it also, exactly in parallel with that, needs people who are capable of articulating very personal, very delicate, very hard-won truth that must not be falsified.
And I wondered whether you feel there's a sense of whether fictionalizing this or putting a lot of actual genuine human experience into the realm of theatre, into the realm of something that is normally made up, whether that helps people sort of come to terms with it and learn perhaps from things that have been done and maybe done to them. Is that something that sort of, is that a thought?
We're in this incredible period where our political life is the fiction. You know, I mean, you know, my country is busy fighting two wars based on obvious lies, you know, and completely fictionalized accounts. And so, you know, bizarrely, the fiction has its own life right now. So, in fact, it's the truth quotient that becomes more interesting in art. And in what way can we offer testimony that stands against the official fiction?
Okay,
and
Peter,
that opens into a more human space?
So, Peter, thank you. Peter Sellers on the line from New York. Thank you very much for joining us. Up next is The Culture Show. Coming up next is the news headlines. You're with Monocle 24.